journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Questions the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, May 6th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The swine flu, beyond the hysteria, an overdue overhaul of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, and a tribute to the late Augusto Boal, the founder of the Theater of the Oppressed. Plus this week's Who Said That?
But I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. The Obama administration is overhauling the Consumer Product Safety Commission, a government agency often criticized for being too cozy with corporations. As part of the overhaul, President Obama yesterday announced the nomination of the commission's new chair, Inez Moore Tenenbaum, a former U.S. Senate candidate and education chief of South Carolina schools. Tenenbaum's nomination is being criticized as overt political payback for the strong support she provided to Obama's election campaign in South Carolina. Still, she has the potential for greatly improving the original mandate of the CPSC in the interest of consumers. The CPSC is currently headed by Nancy Nord, appointed by President Bush. Nord came under intense criticism and calls for resignation for her industry ties and taking trips paid for by corporations. The past several years have seen a spike in product recalls, particularly of children's toys tainted with lead. Last year, Congress passed a groundbreaking piece of legislation, the Consumer Product Safety Improvement Act of 2008, which authorized, among other things, a dramatic increase in the CPSC budget and an increase in the commission's members from 3 to 5. Joining me on the line this morning is Liz Hitchcock. She's the public health advocate with U.S. PIRG. Welcome to Uprising, Liz.
Thanks so much.
Now, glad to be here. Thanks very much for joining us. Your organization has been very much vocal and active on overhauling the CPSC. A lot of what President Obama is doing right now is sort of fulfilling the legislation passed by Congress last year. Let's talk first about Tenenbaum, this person that the president has nominated to head the CPSC. Some say that she doesn't have the qualifications. She doesn't have experience in regulating industry.
Well, I have heard that, but I think what we have here is a nominee who has a history of being an advocate for children and families as a superintendent of education in South Carolina, and has worked on behalf of the public interest and public health throughout her career. So I don't buy that.
Now, what about her predecessor, the person that she's going to replace, Nancy Nord, and how the CPSC sort of changed what it was supposed to do under the Bush administration?
We've seen a couple of things going on over the last 8 years. One thing is the changing marketplace. More products are being made overseas and imported into the U.S. The other thing that we saw was antipathy for regulation in the previous administration, and so we saw the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is the nation's product safety watchdog responsible for ensuring the safety of 15,000 different products, shrink in size, and so we've seen a lot of products fall through the cracks and make their way onto store shelves, into our homes, and have put consumers at risk.
I mean, this commission may sound obscure to Americans, but in fact, it is so important. This is the government agency that is supposed to regulate thousands and thousands of products that we use every day, both in the home and in the workplace, everything from things that children use to items in your kitchen and your home office. I mean, this is supposed to be a commission that protects Americans.
The CPSC was set up to be a watchdog for product safety and for consumers to make sure that the products that we purchase are safe for our use. We have U.S. PERG has focused particularly over the years on the safety of children's products and children's toys in particular. We have released a report for 23 years called Trouble in Toyland, looking at the safety of toys on U.S. store shelves, and have consistently urged the Consumer Product Safety Commission to beef up its standards and to beef up its enforcement of the law.
So the problems persisted before Bush.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission has always been a little agency with a very big job to do. In this past summer, the Congress recognized that there were a number of problems with the Product Safety Agency, some of them exacerbated by the reluctance to regulate in the Bush administration, and made a much long overdue overhaul of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. The law that was passed last summer will give the agency more responsibility, more resources, and more tools to better protect American consumers.
Now, some of the major issues that came up over the past several years, not just the lead in toys, but there was also a major lawsuit against Sears Corporation for endangering millions of Americans by installing ranges that tipped over. People were injured from burns and other major problems while cooking. This is basically, how big is this agency? I understand that Congress has authorized a doubling of the budget. So is it going to have a staff of, several hundred now to try to oversee this very, very large mandate?
We will see an increase in the budget, and Congress authorized a doubling of the budget up to $136 million in 2014, which will allow the agency to increase the staff that they have, particularly doing port surveillance, and to refurbish its decrepit labs. So we'll see many more staff with the CPSC better implementing the product safety law.
What about phthalates in toys? This was there was a big deal about this. These are this is a chemical that's found primarily in plastic, and it's been banned from many other countries, but not banned in the United States up until last year.
Last year's overhaul of the Consumer Product Safety Commission took action on two toxic chemicals. One was lead in children's toys. The other was phthalates. Phthalates are a type of chemical that's used to make plastic softer. You find it in bath books. You find it in rubber duckies. You find phthalates in a number of products and a number of soft plastic products used by children. 10 years ago, we asked the Consumer Product Safety Commission to ban phthalates in children's products. This summer, Congress took action to ban phthalates in toys and other children's products, and we think that that's absolutely a tremendous move. Phthalates have been linked to a number of health problems, reproductive defects, premature delivery, early onset puberty. They have no business in our children's toys.
So the overhaul of the CPSC is all going to include ensuring that phthalates stay out of children's toys. What about the very important issue of toys and other products being imported from countries like China? Is this commission now going to have the muscle to oversee that?
One of the things that the law did was to increase the resources of the CPSC, and one of the ways that they'll increase their staffing levels will be for frontline inspection and import safety staff. So we are optimistic that CPSC will begin to do a better job of keeping toys containing lead, containing phthalates, toys that have other hazards, that pose other hazards to our children, off store shelves in the first place. For years, parents have assumed that if a store shelf had a toy on it, that toy must have been tested by somebody before it made it onto the store shelves. We've warned for years that that actually wasn't true. With this law, which requires third-party testing of children's toys and products that are subject to the standards, parents will know that that's true.
My guest is Liz Hitchcock, a public health advocate with USPIRG. We're talking about the overhaul of the Consumer Product Safety Commission, actually authorized by Congress last year. The Obama administration has now nominated a new person to head the commission, and as per Congress's legislation, expanded the commission's members from 3 to 5. He has named, I understand, at least one, but perhaps two of the new members.
He named a new chair, and that is absolutely terrific because the agency needs new leadership to go along with the new tools that Congress gave them last summer. He also named an additional commissioner, Bob Adler, who has experience with the Consumer Product Safety Commission. He actually was on staff at the CPSC in the 70s and 80s and has worked on product safety issues for a good long time. So
that's the two new members.
Yeah.
That means Nancy Nord, the interim chair, is going to just be a commissioner at this point.
When the Senate approves the nomination of Ms. Tenenbaum, the acting chair, Nancy Nord, will become a commissioner.
Hmm. And what is the difference? Why does it make a difference to have 5 commissioners instead of 3?
It expands the number of people who are focused on product safety and expands the number of voices and just signals an expansion of the agency and so that it can meet its very important mission.
And Liz, as I mentioned, the law was passed by Congress last year. Should the CPSC not have been starting to follow that law and its provisions since the law was passed last year?
A number of the provisions of the new product safety law should have already gone into effect, and they have already gone into effect. As of February 10th of this year, lead and phthalates in children's toys were limited. There are a number of regulations that the CPSC has to clarify for the industry to let retailers and manufacturers know what products are covered by the law, what products are actually exempted from the law, so that a consumer going to the store will have the assurance of knowing that the products that they buy are in compliance with the law.
So did Nancy Nord do what she was supposed to do?
The current CPSC leadership has been slower than we would like in coming up with the regulations and giving guidance to the manufacturers and the retailers and to consumers about the impact of the law. We would be critical of a number of the steps that the CPSC leadership has taken in implementing this groundbreaking product safety law. Mm. They could have done much better.
Liz, let's talk about very briefly the issue of getting toys with phthalates and lead off the shelves. We have been covering this issue on this program for a while now, and there was a controversy that you mentioned just now, which is that stores were being allowed to essentially sell off their existing inventory before they were going to be held to the new standards, which just sounds bizarre. What is the status of that?
Well, what you're referring to is a legal opinion that was issued by the CPSC's legal counsel last fall that suggested that while manufacturing a new product with phthalates in it would be illegal and importing a product with phthalates in it would be illegal after February 10th, selling existing inventory until it was depleted would be perfectly fine. Two of our partner organizations, NRDC and Public Citizen, took the CPSC to court and argued that the law actually required a prohibition on the sale of products containing phthalates, which is what the part of the law is called, a prohibition on the sale of products containing phthalates. And the judge agreed with us and told the CPSC that, in fact, you couldn't sell products containing phthalates after February 10th of this year.
So you had to take the government agency supposed to be protecting us to task. And do you foresee an easier battle in the future or no battles, perhaps?
We will definitely continue to urge the CPSC, whoever is heading the CPSC, to be a vigorous and enthusiastic enforcer of this law. We are optimistic that new leadership will breathe new life and new enthusiasm into this agency that has been downsized and has really... the CPSC's best days are ahead of it.
Well, Liz Hitchcock, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate the time.
Liz Hitchcock is the public health advocate with USPIRG, and we've been talking about the overhaul of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. This is Uprising. Later in the hour, we will have a tribute to Augusto Boal, and we'll be joined in studio by Hector Aristizabal, who was mentored by the late Boal. We'll also, after today's Subversive Historian, go to our weekly contest, Who Said That? And then... we'll take a look at the swine flu with John Barry. He wrote the book, The Great Influenza. Stay tuned.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on May 6, 1940, author John Steinbeck's novel, The Grapes of Wrath, won a Pulitzer Prize. First published 70 years ago, Steinbeck's story chronicled the migration of the fictional Joad family from Oklahoma to California. Set in the Dust Bowl era of the Great Depression, The Grapes of Wrath portrayed the plight of Okies looking for work in California's Central Valley, only to find the exploitation of harsh labor conditions instead. Steinbeck wrote his editor in 1938 saying, "I've done my damnedest to rip a reader's nerves to rags." The novel certainly struck a nerve as it went on to sell nearly 500,000 copies in its first year of publication before being awarded the Pulitzer Prize shortly thereafter. Steinbeck's work did indeed incur a wrath of its own as it also became a target of censorship through the years. But as Oscar Wilde has once said, the books that the world calls immoral are the books that show the world its own shame. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
What is it?
So what do you call yourself? Huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
Who are you?
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know. Oh.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who is this? I've heard that before.
Before we go to our next story, it's time now for this week's edition of Who Said That, a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Here's how it goes. We play you a short soundbite from the Archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. And to win the CD we're featuring, just call in and identify the voice. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
And when you think of some of the terrible things going on, it's not enough to say, oh, isn't that terrible? You've got to feel angry enough to want to do something.
And if you know who that is, and if you haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. A 33-year-old school teacher has become the first U.S.-American fatality of the swine flu. The World Health Organization announced yesterday that the latest global tally of confirmed cases of the so-called swine flu is 1,490. New infections are happening primarily among relatively young people. While the spread of the H1N1 virus, as it's been formally named, has slowed, there is a strong possibility that it could return with a vengeance this fall. The flu's ability to rapidly mutate is of chief concern, bringing into question even the efficacy of producing a vaccine against it in 6 months. Misinformation about the flu abounds, from possible risks of eating pork to conspiracy theories about its origins. Public reaction has ranged from panic over a possible repeat of the deadly 1918 pandemic to nonchalance and denial that an outbreak even exists. But examining the facts suggests that the H1N1 virus is in fact here, is potentially far more dangerous compared to the seasonal flu, and could get a lot worse tomorrow or next year. In his best-selling 2004 book, The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History, author John Barry explores government inaction and widespread panic during the 1981 influenza pandemic. I spoke yesterday with John Barry. He's also a distinguished scholar at the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane and Xavier Universities. John Barry, I had interviewed you on Uprising years ago when your book first came out, The Great Influenza, The Epic Story of the Deadliest Plague in History. So I'm wondering if you thought that in your lifetime you were going to be sitting down and doing a flurry of interviews about essentially this next flu that many are comparing to the 1918 flu.
Well, for us, fortunately, at this point, it doesn't look like it's going to be anything like 1918. I won't say that I was thinking of doing a lot of interviews, but I was thinking, and anyone who understands the virus knows this, that there was certainly going to be another pandemic and another one after that and another one after that. And since the longest gap between pandemics that we know about and going back several hundred years is 42 years, and, you know, it's now 39 years since the last one, so I certainly expected another pandemic in my lifetime and wouldn't be surprised if there's more than one.
So you don't think that this particular virus is going to be, in its current form at least, is going to be the big one?
Well, depends what you mean like by the big one. I mean, we had pandemics in 1889, 1957, and 1968. Compared to 1918, they were relatively insignificant in terms of killing people. You know, but 1918 was the worst. The highest death toll of any disease outbreak in history. So that's not great solace. And the other 1889 was pretty bad. I mean, it was 1957 would be next to that. 68 was the mildest. But make no mistake, even a mild pandemic like 1968, which a lot of your listeners probably lived through and didn't realize they were living through a pandemic, that was still severe, and it actually would probably be hit us harder today than the 68 virus hit us.
So let's talk about some of the reasons why there are differences. Why would a flu like the one in 1968 hit us harder today? What is it about today's conditions?
Well, there are two differences. Number one, influenza usually attacks people with weak immune systems, the elderly and the very young. And we have a lot more people walking around with weak immune systems today than we ever had before, not just demographically significantly more elderly than we did proportionally in 68, but also cancer survivors. There weren't many in 68. There are a lot now. If you had cancer, you probably had either chemotherapy or radiation therapy or both. Both of them damage the immune system for years and in some cases forever. HIV-infected population. Obviously, we didn't have any HIV-infected people in 1968, but they'd be more vulnerable today. There are a lot more transplant recipients walking around than people realize. They're all taking immunosuppressant drugs, and there are other people taking immunosuppressant drugs for other disorders. So in terms of danger to these people, it's much greater than it was in 68, even from a mild virus. The second thing is the economy. We are infinitely more vulnerable economically than we were back then because not only has trade internationally increased significantly, but the entire economy has become much more efficient. And it's a just-in-time inventory system. No one carries, you know, stock. No one stocks warehouses full of stuff that they're going to need later. And what efficiency means is there's no slack. There's no waste. However, if you get even a mild virus is going to infect of the same proportion of people as a more dangerous virus. If you get a lot of absenteeism because people are either sick or they're staying home to take care of their kids or their spouse, then that interferes with the supply chain. Truck drivers are not on the roads delivering goods. Air traffic controllers don't go to work, and that you know interferes with air travel. So the supply chain vulnerable, or all the workers in some factory are out sick, so they don't produce a key part that creates bottlenecks in a huge, large production line somewhere. All those things make the economy far more vulnerable than it was in 68.
Now, let's compare once more to 1918, which is what your book is based on. The science today is far more advanced than in 1918. In 1918, there was a large delay in producing a vaccine because of poor understanding of the flu. Do you think, are you more optimistic about the state of science today in responding to a flu?
In 1918, they didn't have any vaccines at all. They produced some, but they didn't know what caused the disease. So those vaccines were.
They thought it was a bacteria.
Yeah, and they were essentially useless. You know, we can produce a vaccine, but it will in months. It'll take at least 5 months to get any. And it could, before we have large quantities of vaccine, which is by far the most effective tool against influenza, it will be possibly a year before we really have the numbers to protect essentially the entire U.S. population, and not to mention go in much longer than that before there's enough to protect the world population. And in that interim, we have a problem. And even with a vaccine against influenza, I mean, the real problem with the virus is it's one of the fastest mutating viruses in existence. That mutation rate is why it's capable of jumping species. All influenza viruses originate in birds, but the mutation rate allows it to jump from birds to people or other mammals, whether it's pigs, horses, dogs. In fact, in 1918, the virus came first to humans, and humans then gave it to pigs and other mammals. So all those things may, you know, so even if the vaccine works, I mean, a modern vaccine that has somewhere between 70 and 85% protective rate is considered a very successful influenza vaccine because the virus is always mutating away from vaccine, and the production cycle takes so long. So even with that is not a magic bullet. Mm-hmm. It is an enormous help, but it does not solve all problems.
Now, there's a lot of confusion that with competing interests over the fact that the virus is capable of jumping from one species to another. Some countries have gone very far in banning all pig products, pork products. Egypt just mass slaughtered pigs. And the name swine flu has been changed to H1N1 virus instead of swine flu because of the bad association. But did this virus likely jump from pig to human, or is it not? Is it impossible to know?
At this point, it's impossible to know for sure. However, this virus has not been identified in any swine. It happens to own, you know, some of the genes are swine viruses, but some of the genes come from humans and some directly from birds.
And even
so
if it
we
did,
don't really know where this virus came from.
Even if it did originate in pigs, you can't get it from eating pork,
that's
right?
Correct.
I mean, you'd have to be around a sneezing pig,
that's
a live
correct.
Sneezing pig. Okay.
Exactly right. It's, you know, so avoiding pork is totally unnecessarily, and slaughtering herds of swine is just utter wasteful and, yeah, you know, really dumb.
My guest is John Barry. He wrote the book, The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. And interestingly enough, John, Canadian health officials announced over the weekend, I don't know if you saw this, that they have at least one confirmed case of the H1N1 virus crossing from a human back into a herd of 200 pigs. So
I had heard that, but wasn't sure that it was accurate. But I, given what you just told me, I guess it is accurate, I guess.
So also there's a danger that some have cited of, because this virus is so fast mutating, there's a danger to, that it could eventually combine with the with another virus, the human immunodeficiency virus, which causes AIDS.
Oh, no, that's fantasy.
So that's not a danger
at all? That's science fiction.
Hmm. Yeah. And so there is so much misinformation about this particular flu, and that's why I'm having you on to talk about some of these things. Some conspiracy theories about this flu are, I mean, they sound wacky, but they're out there that, you know, that this was something created by the government, the CDC, to test on humans. Are you seeing some of these conspiracy theories, and what do you think?
I've heard some of them, and they're beyond science fiction. But if someone wants to be paranoid or choose to, you know, come up with one of these ideas, you know, the right says that Obama created it so that he could get his health care legislation passed. You know, others say it's a terrorist. They're just not.
There's also that the fact that Tamiflu, the antiviral medication, is something that Donald Rumsfeld has a stake in, and so this could enrich him.
I guess that's one of the viruses on the. I'm one of the conspiracy theories on the left. You know, it's nature is out there. You know, I live in New Orleans. I'm even on the levee board here now, the post-Katrina reform levee board, not the pre-Katrina levee board. You know, we face hurricanes every season. It's a natural event, and that's what this is.
So is there a sense that nothing can be done then, that the flu is inevitable, that you can't postpone it or prevent it, that it's just going to happen? Or is it that the lesson from 1918 is that the government really can do a lot about at least the spread or containment of this virus?
The virus cannot be contained. Mm-hmm. The virus is going to find you unless you're capable of completely removing yourself from all contact with other people for 6 to 10 weeks when the virus arrives in your community. And that means you can't even accept any mail. And your food already has to be in the house. However, that does not mean there's nothing that can be done. Number one, vaccine production takes months. The longer lead time you have, the more you're able to produce it when another wave comes around. I mean, all the pandemics we know about historically have come in waves. And in fact, in 57, that virus sputtered around quite a bit before it caught fire. It took about 6 months, maybe a little longer. And D.A. Henderson, who's a scientist who eradicated smallpox from the world for the World Health Organization, is a friend of mine, and we were just talking this morning. He happened to be a young man working for the CDC in 1957, and he knows a lot about that pandemic, and he sees a lot of similarities there. In 57, for example, you could have some big outbreaks at a Boy Scout camp where he said there were 50% of the kids got sick, but they went home and there was no transmission even in their families, much less the larger community. That was in the initial outbreaks. But, you know, a few months later, it was explosive around the world, and it was pretty severe. I mean, you know, it's not 1918, but make no mistake, it's not something to play with.
So is the lesson here then that even if this particular virus, this H1N1 virus, may seem to be slowing down or cases seem to be mild, that essentially we have a warning signal. We have 6 months. The government has 6 months to begin production of a flu vaccine because it could come back with a vengeance this fall.
That's correct, or it could be longer than a year. Although personally, I think I advanced a hypothesis in my book. I think I may possibly have located where the 1918 virus originated. I think the best evidence I think supports the idea that it entered the human population in Kansas, which is right by through the, you know, a major migratory bird flyway goes through there. And it was 9 months later that it became, and there was a first wave that was extremely mild. And then there was a second wave in 9 months later that was lethal. But there's actually another theory, probably the second leading theory, in my opinion. Others would say, you know, the advocates of that theory would say that's the first leading theory, that it originated in France in early 1916, in which case it was more than 2.5 years during which it was more or less underground circulating, learning to adapt to people before it erupted. So, you know, it could be 6 months before this comes back during the influenza season. It could be tomorrow that a virus suddenly becomes fully adapted to humans and explosive. I mean, the virus, or it could be 2 years, or never. You know, the virus is been transplanted into a new environment. Like or any organism in a new environment, it has to adapt or die. Right now, it's certainly capable of human-to-human transmission, but it is not causing the explosive number of new cases that even ordinary seasonal influenza causes. However, chances are, unfortunately, pretty good that the virus will learn how to be very efficient in infecting humans and come back and bite us later.
John, do you think then that the panic around it was as a result of this flu happening out of season, that if this had happened during the winter time when we expect to see these cases, these numbers of dead and infected wouldn't have really caused much of a spark?
Well, if the virus were identified, then it would certainly create a lot of, let's say it would get everyone's attention at the World Health Organization and among everybody who understands anything about influenza.
Because of the nature of the virus and the fact that it
and
has strains from...
And the fact that from... it's a new virus. That's the scary part. Mm. However, if it had occurred in the middle of the influenza season, it's possible that there'd be a lot fewer people who had been tested to see what kind of virus it is. And it might have circulated for a while, entirely escaping any notice for that reason. But once it's identified as a new virus, the alert system would go red, and we would definitely know about it. How much news it got, that I don't.
Finally, John, what do you make of media coverage of this flu? As I said, there's been a lot of misinformation, but
well, I can say this: that you know, I've actually been too busy to look at much coverage. In fact, you know, for several days, I didn't even have a chance to look at newspapers. And I get three every day normally. And I haven't looked online for stuff. But I know that last week, most of the time, I was trying to tamp down concerns when I was being interviewed, pointing out this is not 1918. It's not likely to become anything like 1918. However, in the last few days, I find myself saying, wait a second, this thing's not over yet, and it is still serious, and it still needs our full attention.
John Barry, I want to thank you very much for your time and for doing this interview.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
John Barry is an award-winning writer and New York Times best-selling author of The Great Influenza, the epic story of the deadliest plague in history. He's also a distinguished scholar at the Center for Bioenvironmental Research at Tulane and Xavier Universities. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. After this short break, the answer to our contest, Who Said That? And then a tribute to the late Augusto Boal. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Maria Armudian, host of The Insiders. If you have an old gas guzzler that you would like to get rid of, consider donating it to your favorite radio station, KPFK. We will tow it away and give you an opportunity to write it off on your taxes. Donating your car will help to ensure the programming you hear on KPFK continues. To donate, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That is 877-KPFK-AUTO.
Programming on KPFK is made possible by listener sponsors. Hundreds of thousands of you over the last 50 years.
You're listening to Uprising, and before we go to our final story, the winner of this week's Who Said That contest is Lee Tischer. Congratulations, Lee, for guessing the correct answer to our contest, which is Pete Seeger. A little bit of background, Pete Seeger is a living legend in American folk music, known for his tireless activism against war, fascism, and the ravaging of the planet. He was most responsible for popularizing the spiritual We Shall Overcome, which became an anthem for the civil rights movement, and it's really difficult to express everything that Pete Seeger has done in just a few moments. He turned 90 on May 3rd and celebrated his birthday at Madison Square Garden with a gala concert featuring Bruce Springsteen, Dave Matthews, Eddie Vedder, and many others. We're going to send a copy of the 2-CD set, The Ballad of Pete Seeger, to our winner. So let's take another listen to the clip that we just played from The Ballad of Pete Seeger that we played earlier in the show.
And when you think of some of the terrible things going on, it's not enough to say, oh, isn't that terrible? You got to feel angry enough to want to do something.
That's, of course, Pete Seeger. For those of you who didn't win, you can order the CD set, The Ballad of Pete Seeger, from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And try another chance at winning the contest next Wednesday. Legendary Brazilian theater director Augusto Boal died this past Saturday at the age of 78 of respiratory failure after a long bout with leukemia. The founder of the movement known as the Theater of the Oppressed was deeply influenced by the philosophy of fellow Brazilian Paulo Freire and his pedagogy of the oppressed. Boal's goal was to use the stage as a platform for social dialogue and to ultimately change society. To that end, he developed methods such as forum theater, which encouraged the participation of audience members as spec actors rather than spectators. Boal also created hundreds of games and exercises for actors and non-actors alike in readying them in a rehearsal for real life. Working with theater professionals as well as rural Brazilian farmers, Boal's work did not find favor with the military dictatorship that ruled Brazil from 1964 to 85. He was jailed, tortured, and then exiled to Argentina. Undeterred, the theater director and playwright returned to Brazil after the fall of the dictatorship, by which time his work in broadening the theater of the oppressed movement had spread internationally. Boal often visited the U.S. and mentored many activists here, including my guest in studio, Hector Aristizabal. Welcome to Uprising, Hector.
Thank you, Sonali.
Thank you very much for joining us today. My profound condolences to you and all the good friends and family of Augusto Boal. You had helped us bring him in studio several years ago here on Uprising when he was visiting the U.S. And I want to actually start by playing an excerpt of Augusto Boal himself, an excerpt of the interview I did with him where I asked him to describe the Theater of the Oppressed.
When I started doing Theater of the Oppressed, it was to answer to social and political conditions of Brazil and most particularly of São Paulo, where I was living. But as this was something new that could be done also in other places, then we started doing Latin America, then all over the world. Now there are more than 70 countries in which we know that there are groups doing Theater of the Oppressed. It's not exactly agitation and propaganda like agitprop. It's in some ways the opposite, because the agitation the propaganda, agitprop, is a form of theater, or many forms of theater, that have as a name to say, you have to do this, this is the best way to solve this problem. And what we bring is not the certitude of what to do, but the question. We bring the doubt as a seed of knowledge. And then what we do in the forum theater, in Rainbow of Desire, Invisible Theater, Legislative Theater, that we are going to do a demonstration here in Los Angeles, all those forms, they are forms in which we question the audience, because what we want is to help the people develop what they already have. Like if we were talking in terms of philosophy, we are Socratic, we are maieutic. We want to bring out from the people the knowledge that they have without having the knowledge that they have that knowledge.
That is Augusto Boal speaking on Uprising, May 26th, 2005. Hector Aristizabal is a practitioner of the Theater of the Oppressed, a good friend, mentored by Augusto Boal. Hector, let's take it a little bit further. Explain it more for listeners who may not have even heard of the concept, what Augusto was talking about. On stage, what does Theater of the Oppressed look like?
Well, it's so wonderful to hear his voice again and to remember when he came to us in 2005 to the 11 Theater of the Oppressed conference that we had the pleasure to organize. Theater of the Oppressed, as he was saying, goes beyond the traditional theater in which people come to the theater, watch a play, like it or not, and go home. And usually during the play, the protagonist goes through a series of ordeals and the play brings an end to whatever happens. Agitprop did the same using Marxism, usually in South America. Many of us engage in that kind of theater. But as he said, we told people what to do because we thought that we knew. So we had a formula for people. And there are many anecdotes, but the most well-known is when they did a play with his group, Arena, the Arena group. They did a play about the peasant movement, the landless movement in Brazil, that ended with the actors as the characters saying, we need to shed our blood for our land. And the peasants were amazed. And he describes this man named Virgilio, toothless and with tears in his eyes, saying, I cannot believe that you, the people from the city, believe like us that indeed we need to shed our blood for our land. So we want to invite you to come with us and take some land back. So anyway, after a long discussion, what Virgilio told Augusto was, oh, so when you said shed our blood, you mean our blood, not your blood.
Right.
And Augusto said he will never tell anyone to do anything that he was not willing to do himself or to take any risks, which is a Che Guevara saying as well. So he developed many techniques. To synthesize them is what we call forum theater, in which what we do is we go to a community, we develop a play based on the problems as defined by the community, their challenges, their oppressions, etc., and we present the anti-model, the worst-case scenario. And then we tell the people, now we're going to start the play again, but we want to invite you to replace the protagonists or the people who are in danger or in trouble in the play, and you can replace them and try something else. So we're not telling people what to do, but we're letting out or leading out, which is the old definition of educare, to lead out. We're inviting people to use their imagination and the stage to find alternatives. So we will see as many alternatives as possible as described and felt by the audience. So the spectators become spectators.
And the theater becomes a tool, not just entertainment or just sort of a one-time thing.
Absolutely. It's a laboratory in which we explore alternatives, and no one has the truth. There's no such thing as an expert. And the joker or the person who leads this kind of work invites people to look for more alternatives. It's more than a facilitator, a dificultator, a person who asks questions and who invites that.
Augusto Boal has moved on, but Theater of the Oppressed continues. How widespread is this movement beyond Brazil, even beyond the United States?
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly widespread. I have had the opportunity to travel during the last 3-4 years offering trainings. And
keep his work going.
Well, I'm very lucky that I was able to learn from him and other people, other practitioners like David Diamond in Canada, Vancouver, Canada. In India, in your country, there is not a group. It's called Jani Sanskriti. It's a movement. It's hundreds of thousands of people using forum theater in the villages, in places where they have never, ever seen theater before. And now they are using Theater of the Oppressed. So that is influencing all over, not only India, Sri Lanka. In Africa, there are many groups. It's over 80 countries now, not 70 countries, as he mentioned. It's sad for us because in July, jokers from all over the world are coming to Rio de Janeiro. We'll be there in July. And we were all planning to see Augusto, and he was planning to see the amazing influence of his work. Well, now we had to come together and celebrate his life and also imagine how we're going to continue the work without his influence. Or he will influence us as an elder now, as an ancestor.
Mm.
And so it's very exciting how widespread this work is. And also, we haven't mentioned so far that when he was forced into exile and ended up finally living in Europe, he discovered that the oppressions in Europe were different. So he developed a more internalized kind of techniques that are called the Rainbow of Desire. And
which we heard him mention in the clip we played.
Yes, and cops in the head, or the policeman in the head.
Hmm.
And these are techniques that are more psychological. As a therapist for many years, I used these techniques as much as I use psychodrama. But there are many people in mental health using these techniques as well. Although Augusto always said, I am a theater person, I am not a psychotherapist. However, I will argue, even as a psychotherapist, that there is nothing more powerful than the imagination and theater and art to work through internalized conflicts. And also, when he returned to Brazil after 85, he developed legislative theater when he was invited by actually Lula's party to run for legislator. And he said, I'm not a politician. I do theater. So they said, well, use those techniques to bring the issues out. And he said, but I don't want to be elected. Well, he was elected. So he argued with them, and he said, well, if I am going to be a legislator, I'm going to use theater. And they said, okay, go ahead. And that's how he developed legislative theater, which is another step in the work that we do when we invite legislators to see the alternatives presented by people and transform them into legislative language.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, during the last few years, he has been working with the Ministry of Culture in Brazil, developing the aesthetics of the oppressed, and that's his latest book. The beautiful thing about Boal is that his work came from his praxis. It was not just a theoretical development, but it came from the practice and meeting with so many people and engaging creatively with them.
And he kept sort of adjusting it and reconceptualizing it, if you will. Let's talk about the event that's being organized locally here to commemorate Augusto Boal's legacy. What's happening on Saturday?
Yeah, and actually we're going to do it. A group of all the people that were able to work with Boal over the years, we're going to get together this Saturday at Parque de Mexico in Lincoln Park, which is near Plaza de la Raza. And we'll be there from 5 to 7 p.m. And actually, the people we are opening the invitation to anyone who wants to come and mourn and celebrate Boal's life. But also afterwards, we could go to Plaza de la Raza and see their latest play, directed by B.J. Dodge, who has been working for over 15 years with young people at Plaza de la Raza. And they always create incredible work. And they use a lot of the techniques of Boal as well.
Mm.
So we invite everybody. If they want more information, they can visit my website at imagineaction.org. And imagine without the E, action. Or they can email Brent Blair, B-B-L-A-I-R, at usc.edu. Brent was a personal friend of Boal as well, and he was instrumental in... Actually, in 2005, when
he was on our program.
Yes,
today,
he was also here. So they could also come.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go.
And that's on Saturday from 5 to 7 p.m. at Lincoln Park.
Yes.
And the website, imagineaction.org. We'll link to all of that information on our website, too, later today if you didn't catch it at kpfk.org/uprising. I want to play another excerpt from the interview we did May 26th, 2005. Again, Augusto Boal talking about the Theater of the Oppressed.
Basically, what is fascinating to me in the Theater of the Oppressed is the certitude that everyone is an artist. The problem is that we are so much inundated by information that we are not, that we have to specialize in being a worker, in being a teacher, in being this, and we forget that we are human beings that can be all of that. No? And then the Theater of the Oppressed tries to develop all the potentialities of each human being. No? Now, we are in another process of creating what we call the aesthetics of the oppressed. It's important that everyone understands that whatever one person can do, everyone can do. Not exactly in the same way, perhaps not with the same special quality that another one does, but we can do everything. I remember that we have many groups, popular groups in Brazil. One of them is a group of housemaids. And then I decided that all the groups that work with us, they should write a poem. And then I told them, too, you have to write poems. And one of them, the housemaid, said, no, but we cannot write a poem because we are not poets. And I said, no, you should not think like that. You have to be a poet to write a poem. It's the opposite. It's by doing that you become. So if you write a poem, you become a poet. If you take the clay in your hands and you transform that in a statue, you become a sculpture. Whatever you do makes you the owner, the one who does that. So you have to do. We are what we do, not only we what they told us we are.
And that's, again, the voice of Augusto Boal, the late Augusto Boal. He died at the age of 78 this past Saturday, and he was on Uprising May 26, 2005. My guest is Hector Aristizabal, a practitioner of Theater of the Oppressed, a good friend and mentee of Augusto Boal. Hector, what was he like as a person? I mean, we hear all of the theory, we hear all of his work, the books, etc. What was he like as a human being?
I'm sure that the people listening to us can hear that in his voice.
Yes.
He was an amazing storyteller and a very playful human being. He was always becoming as his work and as his personality. He was an incredibly energized person, and he was 78. He was traveling even the week before, 2 weeks before
wow.
he died. He
with
never
leukemia.
Stopped. I know. And you will never believe it. And sometimes he got very sick, and we all got very worried. But he was a warrior, but a warrior, or a playful warrior, not the heavy or angry, etc. No, he was always engaged with the imagination, with living philosophy. And that's how you experience him.
Hector Aristizabal, my condolences again.
Thank you
very much for joining us in studio. We'll put information about Saturday evening's event on our website later today. You can also visit imagineaction.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day, Augusto Boal once said, "We are all actors. Being a citizen is not living in society, it is changing it." That's Augusto Boal. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Louise Grillmer is our intern, and Nadia Richardson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of the show after 10 a.m. today on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kulhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8.